Tonight will be no different. Tonight I'll probably be even more transparent than I have been, because we're talking about a subject that's very near and dear to my heart, and that's how we handle doubt, or how do we deal with doubt. The reality is there are a number of people who doubt God and doubt situations. Maybe don't doubt God, but they doubt their faith, and they doubt different tenets of their faith, and they have a hard time in their life, and so they struggle. And they don't know where to go. And we at times have not made it easy for people with doubt to come to us. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But I first want to share my story with this, if you'll allow me just a few minutes to do that. And please, I hope you've realized this week, as I've shared about myself, it's not to brag on myself, but rather to help you understand someone's personal experience that led them to certain places, and that, thankfully, by the grace of God, did not stay in that place, but was able to come back and be faithfully serving God today. When I was a freshman in college, I had gone off to Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville and was a member of the church there at Jerry Whitson. Had a great time there, made many friends. I was in my second semester. And at the beginning of the second semester, we received a phone call. The church in Waverly, the preacher there, Brother Allen, was no longer able to preach due to health reasons. They were a small, little bitty congregation, and they asked if we had some of our college guys who would come over and preach. Now, from Cookeville to Waverly, that's about a 2.5-hour drive, almost 3-hour drive. And one of the families said, we'll make provision for the boys to spend the night with us the night before, you know, so they can come by down on Saturday, spend the night, work with us on Sunday, and then drive home. Well, in February of that semester, it was my turn. There were 3 of us who agreed to do it. And it was my turn because I had, up to that point in life, decided that I would always probably preach in some part-time way or do some part-time work due to some of the influences that I've talked about this week with different individuals. But I got my weekends wrong. And so I was going out with my girlfriend the night before. And so we went out, but it was going to be late. I'd be getting to their house at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I'm just going to go to sleep here, and I'll wake up in the morning, and I'll go down to Waverly, and I'll drive the 2.5 hours then. I didn't sleep well that night. And looking back with wisdom, I know I should have called and said, I'm not coming. But I got in the car. And I made it to the little bitty town of McEwen. Some of you may know where McEwen is. McEwen is only about 15 minutes away from the church building. And I fell asleep at the wheel. I veered into the other lane's 2-lane highway, and I woke up as there was a car headed straight for me. And so I swerved back and got on my side of the road, and I kept going. I don't remember hearing anything. I don't remember seeing anything. But in the next 5 minutes, I passed 4 police cars and 2 ambulances. And this pit was in my stomach. So I got to the church building, and I told them what had happened. And I said, I need to go back and see. I won't be able to preach. I won't be effective this morning if I don't go back and look. So they understood. They said, we'll take care of Bible class. You go, and you know, we'll see you when you get here for worship. So I turn around and I head back. And there's the truck that I had seen and 2 other cars, and there's been a 3-car accident. And what we later learned is I had run that car off the road, and when he overcorrected, he corrected into the car behind me and caused a 3-car wreck. Okay, things happen, right? I won't bore you with all the details, because they're plentiful and many. But I was charged that day with leaving the scene of an accident. I was charged with reckless driving because the trooper believed that I had been texting and driving because I was a 19-year-old kid. And so he assumed something that he did not check. And throughout the next 3 years, we spent in litigation. One to pull my license, one to have me do 6 months in the county jail, because there were 7 people in the accident. There was a lot of damage and a lot of medical injury from the wreck. And here's how my mind worked. I felt like God was punishing me for some reason I didn't understand. And so I started trying to reason with God. Why are you doing this to me? I was just trying to preach your gospel. Why are you doing this to me? Why are you letting this happen? That wreck changed my life in many ways that were not favorable. Put on over 100 pounds, that most of which is still with me today. Had situations with jobs come up that anytime they try to apply for a job, what would they do? They pull a background check, and Humphreys County Sheriff's Department is not well run. I don't care what the state of Tennessee says, given that sheriff, the Tennessean Sheriff of the Year was last year. I had to be looked 3 different times because they kept messing it up, and they didn't get rid of the wrong charges each time. So I learned about 6 years after that I still had a 7-page rap sheet as I was trying to apply for jobs or apply for different situations. It seemed like everywhere we turned, this wreck kept coming up. And it kept causing more and more and more issues. And it just made my anger grow and fester. And that allowed doubt to settle in. Because why would God allow that to happen to someone who was just trying to do his work? And why was I praying and praying and night after night, and it felt like I was talking to empty open air? And if you're truthful with yourself, you'll admit you felt that way at some point. That you were talking to empty open air. Because things weren't changing. Things weren't getting better. And anytime I tried to talk with different people in the church, and maybe I didn't communicate it well, but I was met with this attitude of, you did the crime, do the time, basically. I couldn't understand that. Because I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong. I mean, I immediately returned to the scene of the accident. I wasn't trying to avoid. I wasn't trying to escape. It just was the situation as it was. We had to subpoena Verizon to get my phone records to prove that I wasn't texting and driving to get those charges to go away. I mean, that's some of the things we had to do in this process. And so I felt like we were met with opposition everywhere, and when I went to brethren for help, I was met with, how dare you doubt? No one ever said those words to me, but that was the mentality. How dare you doubt? How dare you wonder? And you know what that did for me? It told me my doubt was true. That if brethren weren't willing to talk about it, then it must be true. Because people who would talk about it was the news media, people online, my friends in the world. And so like I told you earlier this week, I sat in a pew, I sang songs, if I was asked to lead a prayer I did, I wasn't serving God. I was unfaithful, but still in a pew. And I'm thankful for good brethren who made points like this to me that I'm going to make tonight to help me overcome my doubt and overcome my fear and my worry that today I can be a faithful Christian. But brethren, if you think doubt isn't a problem, or if you think doubt is a sign that you just don't have strong enough faith, may I ask you kindly to throw that nonsense away. I'm going to show you tonight that many people in the Bible doubted. Doubt was common. And the statement I like to make is that doubt isn't sinful, but it can lead to sin. And I hope to prove that to you tonight. But I want us to understand, before we really get going tonight, and there's going to be several charts. I'm a statistics person. I have not done this to you this week, but you're going to get it tonight on the last night. I'm going to show you some studies and some statistics to help you understand just how important it is that we have these discussions. But before we do that, I want you to ask yourself if you've ever said any of these 4 things that I'm going to put on the screen. he or she grew up in the church. They should know better. You know they believe in God. And what I mean by that is, you know, you're starting to talk about somebody who seems to be wavering away. Maybe they're not attending anymore, or they completely stopped attending. And we sit around and we talk about them and you go, well, you know they believe in God. Almost like there's no other answer. But yes, they believe in God. How can they be so silly? It says it right there. I think this one always hurt the worst for me. Because I've always considered myself to be intelligent to some degree. And when I wanted to talk about my doubt, it wasn't because I was being silly. It's because I had general concern about what I was reading. It's plain as day, and I just don't understand how they believe it says something different. Have you ever uttered one of these four phrases? I'm not condemning you, please. Because prior to my own situation, I think I probably said some of these about people as well. That top one gets said all the time when someone leaves the church. You know, they grew up in the church. They should know better. And whenever somebody says it to me, I just respond as bluntly but as politely as I can. How do you know that? Have you been talking to them the last several months? I told you this week I grew up in the church. My family did not. I did. My father was serving as an elder when I was going through all of these doubts. Nobody would believe, and there are many in this audience who knew me during that time period that may not have known just how far away I was from the Lord really and truly at that time. Most wouldn't have believed that about me because of my background or who I was. Don't ever make an assumption about where someone is in their life and their walk with Christ. Please, brethren. There was a Facebook post that went out, this has been a couple of years ago now, and it said, the Church of Christ doesn't teach grace. And grace has been a hot topic in online media, printed media, even in the church in the last few years. But let me tell you what they meant by this. The person was commenting about doubt. And they said people aren't gracious towards those that have doubt. They're not long-suffering towards those that have doubt. They don't try to build people up and encourage and strengthen them. They look at them like they have four or five heads when they admit they have doubt. I remember, my parents are in the audience, I remember the first time my parents and I had a true and honest discussion about this situation. Because they didn't know. I was pretty talented, as I told you Sunday, at hiding it from them. And I can just remember my dad, first thing he said to me is, why didn't you talk to, and he named three different people. And I said, I want you to honestly sit here and think, what would their reaction have been had I said, I don't know that God truly exists. They'd have looked at me, having been my Bible teachers over my life, as if I'd lost my mind. I said, what do you mean? Of course he does. He didn't in my mind at that point. And that's what I think is meant by this phrase. This seemed to be the implication on the Facebook post. Was when it says the Church of Christ doesn't teach grace. It's the mentality of we're not gracious towards people when they're struggling. We don't condone sin, never, brethren. But we need to be long-suffering. Paul admonishes us to take care of the brokenhearted, the disheartened, the faint-hearted, those three different phrases that are used. Those are individuals who are going to have doubts and struggles. We're going to be patient towards them. There was a Barna study. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Barna group, I love to look at Barna studies. They do some of the best work about social beliefs and how it is in today's society. In 2017, they listed the top three reasons millennials leave the church. And please, they're using church loosely. I don't have any Barnes doesn't put out how many of different denominations they look at, but just go with me here. Top three reasons. Hypocritical individuals who say one thing and live another. They say God isn't present in the church. It's become just a place of tradition, routine. It's all about the money, etc. And it's not about souls. So God isn't present. Here's number three. Legitimate doubt is prohibited. What do you mean by legitimate doubt? What comes with lying? You realize when you send your kids off to college, when you did send your kids off to college, they're going to a place where there are a ton of people from a ton of different walks of life. Even if you send them to places like FC or a quote-unquote Christian college, you're still going to have people that come from different walks of life. And it's there where the questions that they always wanted to ask but never felt comfortable doing can grow unfestered and can maybe take root in someone's heart and lead them down a certain path. Legitimate doubt is prohibited. We don't let them ask questions, and if we do, we look at them like they're out of their mind. Shame on them. The same year they did a study called The Pervasiveness of Doubt. And the question was, have you ever experienced a time of spiritual doubt when you questioned what you believed about your religion or about God? Only 35%, this is in 2017, only 35% said, no, never. So 65% said, yes. 26% of that time said, yes, I still do. And the rest said, yes, but I worked through it. 65%. I'm going to tell you that number's grown. I found a more recent study. It'll be in a few slides. That number has grown to over 70%. What has experienced spiritual doubt? When you experience this, what did you stop doing? 45% said, I've stopped attending the church or worship gatherings. Now, I want you to catch that. 45% said they stopped attending. What does that mean about the other 55%? They were still in the pews. We get worried about the 45% who walk out. And rightfully so. They're not here. We can physically see it. It's a good moniker. But you realize 55% of them stay. First time I saw that was challenging to me. Because it made me realize there are probably people that I interact with every Sunday and Wednesday who are dealing with doubt. How can I help or handle that? 29% said they quit reading the Bible. The same amount said they quit praying. And then 25% said they stopped talking with friends or family about faith. That's how a few of my friends figured it out for me. Because I wasn't talking as much about that. I talk about anything else in the world other than that. And that's how some good brethren at the Church of Jerry Whitson in Cookeville realized something's wrong with Caleb. And we need to start working on this. When you experience that doubt, where did you go to find your help or answers? This one was sad to see. 40% said they went to friends and family. That's good, hopefully, if their friends and family are strong in their faith. 29% said the Bible. Great. 22% said they went to the local church. 22%. 19 said they shared it with their spouse. And that one's going to be a little skewed because they didn't do a determination on how many singles versus how many married individuals were in the study. So understand that one's going to be skewed. Okay? 15% said they went to religious books, but not specifically the Bible. 12% said they went and searched online. 5% a counselor, 4% a conference or a retreat, 20% other. And I remember looking at the study, you could checkmark multiple boxes. So there were people who didn't go anywhere, according to what the study said, but they didn't have a good number on how to calculate that. This is a more recent study. This is from 2022. In the past few years, if at all, how often have you experienced doubts about your religious beliefs? The total group that they sought, 77% said they have had doubt within the last few years. 77%. I like math. I'm good at percentages. We're going to be a little bit skewed, but that's going to be this entire side of the building tonight. Take a second, look around. See how much this building is lopsided tonight. 77%. That'd be this side of the building. That's how many people have said in the last few years they have had doubt. Amongst practicing Christians, that was the exact same statistic, 77%. Amongst those that were no longer practicing, 82%. Amongst other faiths, so we're talking about Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, 79% of them stated that they had had doubts. This isn't something we share just inside the church. This is a worldwide situation. And here's why I'm belaboring this point just a little bit. You need to understand that there are people inside this building tonight that probably have doubt and are struggling with it. And we don't talk about it. We act as if it doesn't exist. And we're hurting souls by doing so. One more chart for you. They asked individuals to say if this was completely true, somewhat not true, or not true at all. I have gone through a prolonged period of time where I doubted my faith. This is going to be a skewed graph because who defines prolonged? Everybody has to define it for themselves. But still, 72% of those individuals said either completely true, somewhat true, or somewhat not true, but only somewhat not true. I hope you understand that this is important. I have one other chart that I'll be happy to share with somebody if they want to make copies. It just doesn't fit well on a slide. This is the most recent study by Barna, and it asks, which of the following caused you to doubt your religious beliefs? Please select all that applies. Amongst practicing Christians, the number one item was human suffering. Number two, the hypocrisy of religious people. Amongst non-practicing Christians, so those who had gone away, tied for first were those same two. Hypocrisy and human suffering, and then coming in at number two, right after that, was a conflict in the world. All the conflict that goes on in the world. Those who were, they said pastors, but they interviewed several religious leaders of different denominations. They estimated that they believed the number one issue for doubt was past experience with the religious institution. Defining that means church hurt, what we would call it today. Something that happened inside the church that caused hurt in their life. And number two, the hypocrisy of religious people. Doubt's all around us. But it's not sinful. In and of itself is not sinful. Let me give you some examples. Moses. I mentioned him this week. Exodus chapters 3 and 4. Moses was told by God, I am sending you to be a spokesman for the people. And Moses goes through situation after situation. Ha, I don't think I'm the right person. Who am I going to say sends me? Well, what am I even going to say? Well, I'm not eloquent of speech. Lord, just send someone else. Five excuses he gives in Exodus 3 and 4. You know what Moses is doing? He's doubting himself, but he's doubting God and along with that. He's doubting about this situation. Think about Gideon. Gideon put God to the test on more than one occasion because he was doubtful. He didn't believe this to be true. He wasn't sure. And you know, God didn't strike him down for having the doubt. God went through with the test. Okay, Gideon. Okay. Elijah, one of my favorite Bible stories, is 1 Kings chapter 19. In 1 Kings chapter 19, after Elijah has killed the prophets of Baal, Jezebel warns him that says, "So may the gods do to me and more if by this time tomorrow your life is not like these prophets." 1 Kings 19 verse 2. And so Elijah flees. And he goes on a day's journey. And then he asks God this. This is 1 Kings 19 verse 4. "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." We come all the way to verse 9. And he says, "There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' He said, 'I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away.'" You know what Elijah's saying? "God, I did everything you asked of me, and now they want my life. I'm the only one left. Just let me die." Today, "God, I was only doing what you wanted me to do. Why am I being punished?" That's how I felt. That's how I know others felt. And you know what? God doesn't tell Elijah, "How dare you? How dare you say these things to me?" No, he says in verse 10, or verse 11, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper." And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in the cloak, and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Elijah tells him again what he's done. And in verse 15 he says, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you come, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah you shall anoint to be prophet in your place, and the one who escaped from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escaped from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." He says, Elijah here, and I want to suggest you, showing Elijah some concern, he's talking to him in a whisper. You have all these scenery here about the great earthquake, the fire, all this, and that God's not in any of it, but he hears the whisper and he covers his face, which implies he knows that God is in the whisper. He believes he's in the presence of God. He would cover his face lest he see God and die. And God asks him, and he responds, and he says, "I have a plan, Elijah. And you are not alone." Elijah's having some doubt. But God responds to it. You have John the Baptist. I believe that in Matthew chapter 11 we see some doubt occurring. And then you have the apostles. These both be on the screen just a moment, so I'm going to flip through them. The apostles in Matthew 28, same thing. Look at Matthew 11, verse 2 through 6. Matthew 11, verses 2 through 6. "Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, 'Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?' And Jesus answered them, 'Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them, and blessed is the one who comes and is not, blessed is the one who is not offended by me.'" Now, I personally believe that John the Baptist, at the end of his life, as he's about to die, has some concern, maybe we would call it doubt. Has the work that he's been sent to do been fulfilled through Jesus' coming? I recognize that's not a popular opinion among brethren. But even if it's not John the Baptist's doubt, his disciples are surely fixing to have doubt. John's disciples. Because their teacher, who they've been following, is about to die. And Jesus doesn't say, of course, you know me. We've had this conversation before. You're the one who called me the Lamb of God who came to take away the sins of the world. Jesus uses Scripture. It says, you go and tell John what you hear and see. And he quotes prophecy from the Old Testament. That the blind would see, that the deaf would hear, that the lepers would be cleansed, and so on and so forth, the lame would walk. He quotes that these things are being fulfilled. So they don't have to worry about them. Because this is all now coming to fruition. In Matthew 28, verses 16 through 20. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them, and when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, and then we know the rest, we've looked at it this week, the commission to go out and teach. But do you notice what Matthew records? He doesn't say, and Thomas doubted. We all know that Thomas doubted. He says, some of the disciples doubted. Jesus came to them, and he assured them that the work that they were doing was only just beginning. He eased their doubts. How do I deal with my doubt? Let me make a few points about my own doubt. We'll make some about how we help others with their doubt, and the lesson will be yours. Recognize that doubt is not sinful, but it can lead to sin. It can lead us to say false things about God. It can lead us to go away from God. Doubt in and of itself is a natural human reaction based on situations that we find ourselves in. You have someone who's been faithful to God for a long time and they get sick, and you pray, and they don't get healed. You know what happens to some people? They start doubting. Because why? With someone who's been so faithful to God, did he not heal them? And we start playing this why game in our mind. The doubt itself is not sinful, but it can lead us to go away from God. And so we need to keep it from going that far. We need to be willing to ask questions. Part of my problem was I tried to ask a little bit and I got shut down, so I just quit. And there's been some good brethren who have heard this lesson before and heard some of the things that I, or read some of the things I've written about this, and they've called me almost in tears and said, why didn't you come talk to me? And I said, because I was just tired. But let me say this to all of you. If there's no one else in your life you can ask questions to that you won't be judged by, you can call and ask me. I don't care if I barely know you or not. Ask questions. Get answers. Don't allow it to fester. Don't allow it to go to a place of sin. May I also suggest that you turn towards your doubt and not away from it? What do I mean by that? Sometimes we like to take our doubt and we like to just put it in a little box and pretend as if it's not there. And what's happening is it's growing and it's festering and it's trying to get out of the box, and eventually it dies and it overtakes us. Lean into your doubt. Questions you've got, ask them. Things you're not sure about, find out. Don't go away from your doubt. Turn in, seek answers, and have it resolved. Find assurance in the Word of God. Kids sometimes doubt that their parents love them. And what often happens is they begin acting out. Because they're seeking, does somebody care? Does my teacher care? Do my parents care? Do my grandparents care? Etc. They're looking for assurance somewhere that someone sees and someone knows. If you don't find assurance in people, don't let that change your view on God. Find assurance in His Word. There's a lesson that I sometimes prepare. I'll be happy to share the material with anybody who'd like it. Does God care when I'm suffering? And what we do in that lesson is we just start from the very beginning and we see people of God from the very beginning all the way through the New Testament who suffered and how God was there with them, just like He was with Joseph last night when we looked at Joseph. And find assurance that God does care when His people suffer and that God is nearby. I think of Matthew 7:7. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. You manage your own doubt, whether you realize it or not. But what do I do if someone comes to me with their doubt? First thing, don't say any of those four phrases that were at the beginning. I have jokingly said to members at Rock, maybe they can confirm it or not. It's been a while since I've done this lesson, so they may have forgotten it. But I have jokingly said at Rock that if I ever heard a member say one of those four statements, I'd deal with them first and then go deal with the person. Don't say those statements. Don't make assumptions. Don't believe you know where someone's at in their life. Be helpful. And if your first indication is not, keep your mouth quiet. Please. Don't do more damage by saying something unkindly. Here's some vast passages for you to consider. Jude 22. Jude writes, and have mercy on those who doubt. Galatians 6 verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Doubt is a burden that we carry. Help your brother or sister with it. Don't diminish them for it. Help them out. 1 Timothy 2 verse 1, first of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all people. You know what you can do if there's nothing else? Pray for them. Make prayer for them. Pray for them in the situation they're dealing with in their lives. And let them know you're praying for them. That means a lot. That was a big part of me coming back to the Lord. Was brethren who would text me and say, I'm praying for you, I'm thinking of you today. Knowing that people cared. In 1 Corinthians 8 verse 9, but take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Just because you're strong, just because you understand something easily, don't make it a stumbling block for someone else that's struggling with it, that isn't sure about it. I don't think this would be offensive to anyone in here. But you know, that was a lesson that my dad taught me without even realizing it. I give him a kudos on one tonight. I'd gone off to summer camp. And at camp, learning how to lay singing, we were taught how to use it with a pitch pipe. How to start a song with a pitch pipe. None of the men in my congregation used that. And I remember talking to my dad about it, and he said, well, there are some members here who feel that it's sinful to use pitch pipe. And I go, huh? Never heard that before. And basically what dad said is, while I don't agree with it, what harm does it do not to use it? It's a stumbling block for them. So why press the issue when we can easily sing without it? He made a lot of sense. He didn't always, because I was a teenager. But he made a lot of sense. Be careful not to stress something so far that you hurt somebody in their doubt, in their concern. At times in life, we all have doubted. And I'm ashamed to say that's true of me. I'm ashamed as I look back and think about that time period that I was lying to people around me, pretending like I was faithful. And I understand, and I'm not justifying it, but I understand why I did it, because I felt hurt by the couple of times I tried. Brethren, let me make another suggestion to you. When you don't ask questions, and when you don't ask for help, you are robbing, brethren, of the opportunity to bear your burden. And there were many people who would have bore my burden with me. And I didn't let them. And it became so heavy. That I fell underneath it. And I thank God every day for the people who helped me overcome it. And I pray that I can do that for someone else. We all have doubts. They will come if they haven't already. Let's be open in our discussion about it. Let's be willing to talk about it. And we just might find that we'll save a bunch of souls doing it. I could easily be outside of the church today had it not been for those good people. And I call them by name when I thank God. And I thank God that He put them in my life. How do you handle your doubt? Maybe you have some this evening. Just because the meeting's ending tonight doesn't mean that I'm not willing to still talk with anyone. And even if it's a few days from now, ask several of the men, they have my contact information, or ask me tonight, I'd be happy to give it to you. Let's make sure that if you have any questions, they're answered. I've liked Brother Smalley has said it most nights this week. A Bible question for, or a Bible answer for a Bible question. That's what we should be doing, is answer any question that comes our way. Maybe you're here tonight and you have questions. I didn't talk 2 hours, so I guess I have time that I could sit and talk with you afterwards. I'd be happy to talk with you. That maybe you already understand your situation. And that while you may have been away from God, you need to come home. You need to return to Him to be faithful. Maybe you have never obeyed His will. A lot of young guys that I've talked to have had doubts about that. Doubts about how do I come to Christ? What do I have to know? What do I have to be living like when I come to Christ? And my easiest answer is always, go read the conversion of Philippian jailer. Because how much could he have known when he became a Christian? We sometimes get it out of order. We try to put the Christian life before becoming obedient to the will of Christ. And we get that out of line. So tonight, if you're outside of the body of Christ, why are you waiting? Because you have doubts? You're not alone. But know this, no one's ever loved you as much as Jesus. No one's ever given up as much for you as Jesus did. And He wants you to be in His family. He died for you. And He'd love for you to come and be His child. And tonight, if you understand that Jesus is the Son of God, and that you understand that He died for your sins, and you're willing to make the great confession and strive to live a life pleasing to God, what a great way it would be to end this gospel meeting by you coming and being a Christian and being baptized for the remission of your sins. So tonight, if we can help you come to Him or return to Him, don't leave this place apart from God. If we can help you, won't you come as we stand and sing songs?